Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views with Chris Fitzsimon.
Welcome back to News and Views. The explosion of for-profit colleges in the last 30 years has created new problems for many families, as people lured in by aggressive marketing ploys have found themselves with mountains of debt and a degree that isn't worth much in the marketplace. Barmak Nasirian with the American Association of State Colleges and Universities was in Raleigh this past week to talk about the problem, and he sat down with News and Views. Well, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Let's talk about for-profit colleges, the effect they're having on a higher education system, but maybe first a little context. How long have they been around?
Well, for-profit education and training has been around for as long as the Republic has been around. There have been trades where we need to replace existing workforce. So there is somebody is a plumber and they get an assistant, and that was the pathway, typically through apprenticeships, where people got into the trades. The for-profit education financed by the federal government dates all the way back to the creation of the student aid programs in 1973. And back then, it was a fairly straightforward, completely comprehensible concept where for-profits were typically focused on, again, vocational trades, vocational technical training. What has happened over the intervening decades is that the underlying practices have changed, but federal law didn't catch up with them. So 20 years ago, you'd have a very difficult time finding a for-profit provider that granted degrees, let alone doctorates. But that has happened over the course of the decades. And part of the concern is that the model has become increasingly vacuous, that the fields and the majors and the content of the training is mostly embellishment and of very little labor market value. The debt is very real, but the outcomes are not the ones that you would normally put your own money in.
I'm sure you've heard the arguments from folks who think this is all the market working the way the market is supposed to work.
I am not unsympathetic to the concept of market forces working their will. But who's kidding whom? By the time you have $200 billion of federal money, you know, swishing about the system, you've left the market behind. In fact, one of the points I usually make to people is that defrauding low-income people tends not to be a particularly lucrative field on this scale anyway, primarily because they don't have money. This whole process begins with the injection of massive amounts of federal subsidies in the form of vouchers that we stuff the pockets of poor people with, and then we send them into this mythical marketplace where they get ripped off. That's the problem. If I have no issue with market forces working the way they're supposed to, but in this case you have if it's capitalism, it's a form of crony capitalism. It's a form of capitalism where the money begins from the public coffers and then kind of cascades down into a system that is just not adequately protecting low-income people.
And low-income people are, I guess, especially vulnerable. I mean, if you just turn on the radio these days, you'll hear ad after ad for various for-profit higher education entities. And I guess, is that especially worrisome in a time when so many people are still struggling to find jobs that pay enough to live?
It's interesting because your neighbors and mine are almost automatically immune to this pitch. The pitch works amongst some of our most vulnerable populations, people who have absorbed and internalized all of the messages we give them. Stay in school, invest in yourself so you can feed your family. They're acting on the basis of their best instincts and on the basis of everything we tell them. It's really our fault for not vetting the providers to make sure that what people are promised is remotely similar to what they actually end up getting.
What happens in a typical case? Let's just say that the Acme for-profit higher education entity advertises, somebody responds to that ad, it enrolls. Tell us how it happens.
It's never that simple because, and in fact, this is one of the most important characteristics of the industry. If you leave labels aside and attempt to be empirical about it, it would be much more accurate to describe these organizations not so much as teaching operations, but as sales operations, where the object of the transaction is really secondary to the process, where you are basically engaged in very heavy advertising and extremely heavy-handed sales tactics. So what we all hear on the radio and on late-night TV, etc., on the web, is just the tip of the iceberg, because once you engage in a bilateral transaction with them, once they get a phone number for you, the barrage of individualized sales calls begin. I mean, it's just extraordinary. I'm talking 40, 50 calls within a matter of a few days. So it's a very commercial environment, and it's a very unregulated environment where all kinds of representations and misrepresentations are made to the individual. And it's usually, and we've seen the internal documents, by the way, where they talk about finding where the pain is and hitting the person at their, don't you want to feed your family? Don't you want to be a responsible parent? You know, that's those kinds of lines. Don't you want to make something of yourself? And once the person is hooked in, you create the pressure. Oh, by the way, if you need to act now, you need to act now. Classes are starting tomorrow. This is your last opportunity. All of it false, by the way, because classes start basically every other day. The person gets sucked in.
The script and the way you're saying this, it almost seems like the predatory loan industry in many of its characteristics.
It is very much that same process, with the big difference being, again, that every low-income American is walking around with a line of credit that they don't even know about.
What can we do about it?
Well, it's interesting. You know, as I walked into this building, it didn't even zip through my head to check the building permit and make sure that the beams were not undersized, because, you know, in American life, we make the reasonable assumption that in general, most transactions have been vetted by somebody whose job it is to make sure that horrific things don't happen. We certainly don't expect anybody to advocate for us at every turn, but it just doesn't enter our minds that outrageous fraud can go on completely legally. So what we ought to do about it, first and foremost, is change the framework by which this industry is regulated. But the second thing we can do about it, that's been a long-term project, and I don't know how well it's panned out, quite frankly, since, as I pointed out, this all began in 1973, and the behavior it's been put on steroids because of the fact that, you know, you now have the internet and distance education and all kinds of additional mechanisms. But in general, the behavior hasn't been terribly different. I mean, we've had waste, fraud, and abuse in this sector ever since it got its hands on federal money. But the most important thing that has worked has been public information. As the communities that are targeted by these operations begin to reap the bitter fruits of what has happened, consciousness of the problem broadens, and we see that now. We see that now. This sector is in free fall because of the feeding frenzy of the past decade or so.
What happens to a student who, you mentioned some of the education isn't the quality that they were promised. How does a person end up in debt if there's federal money involved, for people who don't quite understand that? And then what recourse do these students have?
Well, you end up in debt because the initial representation, and you see it in bold letters in virtually all of their advertising, is the availability of federal financial aid. And the assumption any reasonable person would make is that, well, that's gifted. Well, like, yeah, you know, part of it, a small part of it maybe, but the bulk of it is student loans. And those loans very typically end up in default. Not because the individual is unwilling to repay the loan, but because they were basically ripped off. They didn't receive value. There was no wage enhancement. And what they have to show for their quote-unquote education is, you know, a huge amount of debt that is completely unrepayable from any kind of an economic analysis perspective. So they end up in default. And default on student loans is just about the most horrific kind of indebtedness I can think of. It is much better to be delinquent on taxes to the Internal Revenue Service, for example, than to be in default on student loans, because they follow you all the way to the grave. Not only do they garnish your wages, not only do they offset your tax refunds, they actually offset your Social Security benefits to recoup not only the amount of the default, but the accumulated interest and all kinds of penalties. So it's a pretty sad outcome, and there isn't much recourse, mostly because the individual has been stigmatized by the time the outcome of the transaction becomes clear. You know, they're now a defaulter.
Well, thanks for all you're doing to try to prevent that. We really appreciate you coming to North Carolina, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
That's it for another edition of News and Views. Look for us on the web at ncpolicywatch.com. For producer Clayton Hinkle, this is Chris Fitzsimon. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week.
You've been listening to News and Views with Chris Fitzsimon, director of North Carolina Policy Watch. Visit them online at ncpolicywatch.com. News and Views, a weekly look at state and policy issues, is a production of the North Carolina Justice Center.